and see if we can get some questions going. Actually, if no one has a question for me, I have a question.
I'm going to bring up a topic that we talked about when we sat together last 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. No one is arguing in favor of child labor. But the child labor's wages contribute to family sustainability. In often cases, it could make or break the subsistence of the family. So if you stop child labor, how do you replace the income that the family needs to survive?
I don't know if I'm the right person. Xenia, do you want to answer this too? I'll take a stab at it, but she's got a lot more experience than I have in this.
Yes, I think you are right and not right at the same time. Child labor should be stopped, but the income is necessary for the families, and therefore the solution cannot be to just say no wherever it appears. It has to be seen in a way that makes it less heavy for children and find a way out of child labor. And ILO is now working on this concept of decent work, and of course decent work includes no child labor, but if child labor exists, we cannot say, ILO cannot say we don't accept it. We have to find ways to make it more acceptable. And so we have found ways which are not unhealthy or as unhealthy for children as it was before and so forth. There are many ways and best practices how the kind of working conditions, if I may say so, for children can be improved. But of course, from an overall viewpoint, child labor cannot be accepted. But if it exists, it is better to find ways that makes it more acceptable than to say we don't see it and so we can't do anything.
Yeah.
Sure. Oops, it's working. There you go. I'd certainly defer to my expert colleague from the ILO, but the you really hit on it. It's many of these things. People with goodwill want to say, I want to stop child labor, I want to boycott rugs that are made by children or whatever, sweatshirts that are made, so on. And students will get together and actively boycott that and so on, and changes are made without wondering or even thinking about what's the consequence for the children who made those. There was an article in the New York Times a while back, and I know you're not arguing this, but made the point that sweatshops for children were actually a good thing, because without those sweatshops, those children would have no income to bring back to their parents and so on. I know you're not arguing that. But that simply doesn't go far enough. I mean, what are the root causes that mean that children have to be working instead of doing what they're doing here, or generally here? And so you hit a good target, namely something systemic has to be done about the root causes of poverty and unemployment, lack of schools, for example. You say the children should be in schools, well, they have no school. So things need to be done at that basic hardcore level. It's a good point.
Kevin?
It's the question about aging and the politics around that. Where do you see the balance between, on the one hand, individual rights to work on as long as they want, the abolition of mandatory retirement age and so forth, and some kind of intergenerational contract in which today's contributors pay for tomorrow's beneficiaries and so forth? Because I'm not sure if you allowed a significant increase in the participation of older workers in the late 60s and early 70s, what would be the knock-on consequences of that down the age structure in terms of participation between the age of 15 and, say, 25? And that cohort is one of the key, if you like, victims of the current crisis in terms of worklessness and so forth. So older age workers if you like, staying on in positions, often because they don't have options to retire, and at the same time holding back or closing off employment opportunities for younger people. I also, finally, I mean, first of all, I'd be fantastically wary of all this demographic argument. You know, it's been peddled by the World Bank. I think it falls down at very, very close examination. And it's a pretty strong neoliberal kind of argument there. But I think also we need to have a, if you like, a more positive take on life in retirement and policies to produce that. I was driving down to see my mother-in-law in an old care home recently, and my wife and I drove past this caravan, and the caravan had a slogan on the side of it which said, "Adventure before dementia." So I think it was just kind of the idea that in old age, you know, you can have that age group has a much more positive, you know, way of making use of the free time.
You're raising an interesting point, and certainly one that my daughter and I have had this discussion from time to time. I call it the Soylent Green scenario. I don't know if you say that movie, Soylent Green, but, you know, where Edward G. Robinson goes in into the euthanasia clinic and decides to kill himself because life isn't, you know, bearable anymore. And that's, you know, younger workers, I think, would like to be able to say, here, older workers, here, have a glass of Chablis, you know, take this pill, smoke a joint, do whatever you want, but find, you know, get out off the planet and make room for the rest of us. And that's
I'm so glad I came here.
Yeah, but yeah. But you know, it's funny because I've, you know, as CARP has lobbied for the abolition of mandatory retirement from time to time, we've seen the comments that come back, because you can see the article and then all the postings below it, and then, you know, get these old buggers out of the workforce fast, you know, is a prevailing sentiment. It's problematic. I mean, I see the sad part is I think there is the opportunity for intergenerational melding, the knowledge transference, the skills transference, such you know, I'm not talking about this is the way we did it in the old days, kid. You know, not that kind of stuff, but more of the kind of stuff where there actually is institutional memory within certain kinds of organizations that can be passed along meaningfully, some skills, some, you know, oh, I saw that scenario 30 years ago, and maybe that might be helpful to somebody. And there is an opportunity for that kind of thing. I'm not saying that older workers have to remain in their primary employment for the rest of, you know, till they drop off. And in fact, most people wouldn't want that. In fact, if there were a way for most people to retire, I think they would like to and do something else. The problem is that today, particularly in the economic situation that many seniors find themselves in, is they don't know how much they need to retire, and they don't know when precisely they're going to die. And they don't know how much they need to support themselves, healthcare-wise, lifestyle-wise, or whatever it is. And I'm not saying to keep, you know, the big 5,000 square foot house and, you know, the four cars and everything else. I'm, you know, even in a downsized existence, they still might need, you know, $2,000 to $3,000, maybe $4,000 a month in Canada to live in some modicum of existence. And it's. They have to be able to make that kind of money, whether it's through the system or through their own devices. Anyways.
Really a little bit out of my ballpark, but the Universal Declaration of Human Rights talks about a right to work. And that has been interpreted generally by the ILO and otherwise as a right to have an opportunity to work. And I think that's a mistake. I take the right to work very literally. And I see there's a sense that there is a kind of zero-sum game, particularly if we're looking at only at private employment, that there are only so many jobs, so many of those jobs are being filled by quote-unquote older workers, and younger workers want them out of there because they want their chance. I see no reason why there should be any kind of major unemployment at all. In the United States, for example, roads are falling apart, bridges are falling down, all kinds of stuff needs to be done. In World War II, and in the Depression, we had a Civilian Conservation Corps, we had a Works Project Administration. There's no reason why people are unemployed. They could be employed. A lot of people in the private sector don't want that because they see competition from the public sector. But there are lots of training there are lots of training that could be done, skills that could be learned, and lots of good things that could be accomplished in the meantime, even if we just wait for private sector employment to expand again. But I see no reason for this. There are only so many jobs to go around, other than reality, which is that's the way we approach it, and that's the value scheme that we have.
Okay, I've got another question here.
I'm not arguing for or against mandatory retirement, but by not retiring at an age, you may be putting business at a disadvantage by increasing their health care costs, disability, and workers' comp costs.
Well, I think there's been arguments that have been made both for and against that scenario. Many older workers have a household that only has one or two residents, not kids getting the flu all the time or having needing medication for ear infections and things of that nature. Their families have a high cost of health care as well, but that doesn't seem to be factored into the equation either. I think it's if you look at the 100 fastest growing industries in North America, I think you'll see that there's really no danger of that happening anyways, because they're all in areas where they place a premium on high cognitive ability. Well, guess what? That's one of the first things that starts to go as you age. You know, you start losing your ability to learn new skills. You start losing the ability to, everything, your vision, your hearing, all those senses start to deteriorate as you age. So they're seniors are generally underrepresented in the fastest growing industries anyways. There are other opportunities though for older workers besides working at in a silicon manufacturing plant or something like that.
Dora,
microchips.
Do you want the last word on this?
I don't know if I have the last word, but if you take a look at this from a societal point of view, and I'd be interested to know if there's any studies on that. What's the cost of not having people engaged? And I'm using it maybe more broadly than just working in that, but and that's why maybe this is anecdotal, but I hear and know so many people who want to continue in some form in terms of contributing back, and a lot of times that's in some type of work or employment. And so you maybe don't have the health costs at one end in terms of an organization, but do you have health costs in other ways through depression, through the fact that there's other costs of not working for these people, and also cost to society because you don't have them engaged and they can contribute back in ways that we're not tapping? So I don't know what the studies show.
We have time for one more. I'm in a conflict of interest on this. I declare a conflict with other members of the panel.
Just a question, whether CARP looks at voluntary work at all. I know that's a whole different issue, but I think there's some really interesting Canadian studies that are being done on the effective and contribution that older workers are making to society through their volunteer work.
Well, sure, but volunteerism across the whole spectrum is down almost at record levels. The rates of volunteerism are dropping. A lot of the old post-war service organizations, things like Rotary, Kiwanis, Lions Club, and all those they're gone almost in many cases. These they don't exist anymore because there's no infrastructure. There's no population base to support it. So what you end up, what a lot of these organizations are faced with, is a bunch of old folks standing around the table wondering where the heck everybody went. And there isn't as much volunteering as there used to be. We're looking at ways to encourage volunteerism today, but the fact of the matter remains is that many people simply need to earn a living. It's not a matter of just giving back to society at this point in time, although that's part of it. It's just being able to make a living. I mean, look at all the number of people that were affected by the recent financial meltdown. My dad lives in Boca Raton, and he knows personally guys that have been wiped out by guys like Bernie Madoff and so forth. I mean, these folks that in some cases had estates worth, millions or even tens or hundreds of millions of dollars are now moving back with their kids. They have no choice.
Okay. We're at break point. You have a quick comment? Does anybody want to? I thought I saw a finger going up. Okay, let's, all right. I think they want you to talk into the mic.
So we're still having the same retirement plan that were developed for a life expectancy of 70.
Yes. Well, in fact, if you take a look at the new study, the Canadian Institute of Health Information in CIHI just came out with their 2009 report. Life expectancy has gone up 3 years just in the past 10. All right. So older workers don't know, older people in general just don't know how much money they need. The sandwich generation keeps elongating.
But it's not just that. Is we're expecting to be working for 30 years or so, and we're going to be living for 30 years or so on the earnings that we've made for 30 years. So it's just like doesn't make economic sense or financial sense.
Right. That's the dilemma.
Okay. Thank you. We'll be back. Fifteen minutes.